Hello and welcome to another episode of the Global Product Management Talk, what we're calling the Lean Spec Startup Product Definition Process.
We'll narrow it down at some point.
Yeah, well, working title. I'm Cindy F. Solomon, delighted to be your host. I'm here with Malcolm Knapp.
Hello.
And our special guest today is David Ordal.
Hey, folks.
And this is episode 16 in the continuing saga of honing in and being transparent about our struggle or attempt to create a, not a standard, but a process that is implementable across various types of products. For to train product managers. Mm-hmm. So just to give you a little bit of context, my interest in this process is because I work weekly in product therapy with product managers. I mentor and coach them. Often they'll be dropped into a product midstream, and there's no one else who's done their job before, and so they have to sink or swim. There's no process in place. There may be an agile development process, but there's no product management process. I've also seen a lot of new products available to help product managers develop their process, but none is a real orientation of where should they start, how do they communicate cross-functionally, how do they bring people in, and how do they document what the understanding of the product is. And often the product managers come in too late when there's a bottleneck or when there's a problem, because there are certain things that hadn't been thought of ahead of, or there's the different team members have different perspectives on what the product is. So I'm excited about this process, not only because it's a perfect vehicle for teaching product managers about expectations of what they're going to confront, but as well as a way of communicating from different perspectives of coming up with a cohesive, potentially visual way of representing all the different perspectives of the product.
Basically, the idea is that you cannot capture all the aspects of a product in just text or just graphics, or you have to sort of, and you know, you have to basically look at different places to get a look at different parts of a product to get a full picture about what's going on.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah.
So that's our intro. I want to intro David, that we're delighted to have as a guest. He's the CEO of Everbooked, which is a demand-based pricing startup, and Exavault, a business file sharing startup. Previously, he worked as VP of engineering at Hudler.com and as CTO at CyberSense. His passion in the area of expertise is building technology companies. He's well-versed in both technical and managerial aspects of fast-paced, agile software development and the lean startup methodology.
It's great. happy to be here. And yeah, you know, I mean, I think one of the interesting things, Malcolm, is that, you know, I've known you for a while. Mm-hmm. You come at this from a hardware background,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So that's your
yeah.
view of the world. And I largely come at this from a software background.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, there are some similarities, but there are a lot of differences.
Well, and so this is the thing, is that there's a big differences in implementation and how you go about things. But what I'm thinking about and trying to see is if there's some similarities because in the sort of how you think about what you're making. And this was actually, I created this process because I was in consulting companies, and I saw that at the beginning of projects, people would start making, like, you know, coding or like doing schematics before they really understood what they were making. And pretty quickly, they would, you know, after they got their first like model out, it was like, oh, we didn't really want that. We wanted something completely different.
Yeah.
You know? Or there was, but whether you misunderstood what we were really getting at. And so I created the, I call it product definition process to as a first phase to define what was going to be made and then to actually make it. And so what I like to start with in this sort of thing, because we're talking cross domains, we sort of start, the first question is, do you think that when you're thinking about a product, that all the information that you need to make that product, basically, do you think that's a sort of finite amount of information?
Finite, no, but you can get pretty far thinking ahead.
Well,
so,
so what do you mean no? Why do you say no?
So there's, I guess I would interpret that question as asking, can you sort of understand all the information up front?
That's not what I'm saying.
All right.
What I'm saying is when you're done,
yeah,
that you look back and you have all the information, you know, this is like basically all that information to make the product is captured in all the code that's been written, all the sort of manuals and all the sort of stuff like that, all the graphics that have been made, everything that's there is, you have all the stuff you need to know to actually make a product.
As it stands today, I mean, I think, you know, at least, and I guess this might be a little bit different in the hardware world, because you guys, you know, in the hardware world, you build a product and deploy it out in the world and sort of out there.
Yeah.
Software, you're sort of always iterating on, right? You're always improving, you're getting requests from customers, things like that. And so, you know, from a software standpoint, is there a finite amount of information that you need to know to make the product as it will stand 2 months from now? Sure, there might be.
Yeah, but that's...
But is there a finite amount of information that you need to know to make the product as it's going to stand 3 years from now? Probably not.
Well,
I'm always thinking about launch.
Yeah.
You think of, what do you need to know to launch this product publicly?
Yeah. But so there is a defined amount of information you need to know to get to some certain stage, right?
Yeah.
To launch or to, you know, the next iteration. And I think one of the things that people don't do a lot of, it reminds me of the old G.I. Joe line from the 80s. They'd have these commercials and they'd say, knowing is half the battle. And they were talking about down power lines and not to, as a, you know, 10-year-old, not to go pick up a down power line. But it applies equally here in that knowing what you actually want to do, what you actually want to make, literally is probably about half the battle.
So let me just sort of jump in there. And this distinction about, this is not a sort of planning everything up front and then the moment you hit reality, it all goes away. This is about this idea it's finite, that you have this sort of information space, you know, multidimensional, whatever, but you can sort of think of it as a space and there's an edge to it, basically.
Yeah.
Okay, so the next question is, within that space, is there a hierarchy to the information, as in there's some information that's dependent on other information?
There's information that's dependent on other information, and I would also argue that you don't necessarily get to knowing what that space is exactly defined as until you know it, which means until you're done. So the trick in my mind is to get, and I think part of the process you developed and the process that we go through, is to get as much of the most important information as quickly as possible, so that you can get to that point of being done as reasonably possible.
Yeah, and so this is the other part about it, is that this process doesn't view design and development as checking boxes and just sort of when you checked all the boxes, you're done. It views it as a sort of discovery process. You're exploring the space and you're not done until you've explored the whole space.
Yeah.
But the key thing is that there are stuff at the high level. There's sort of the things at the highest level in the hierarchy.
Yeah.
You know, and so for you, you know, when you're doing your work, what is that? What's at the highest level?
Well, I mean, I think you need to understand a couple of things. I think you need to understand what you think the product should do,
what do you mean by that? What, like, break that out?
Well, we do software products, right?
Yeah.
So, and a little different hardware. We do software products, and so the idea is that basically, what are the capabilities that the product needs for either an MVP, minimum viable product, or if you're beyond the MVP, what are the capabilities it needs for sort of the next release? You need to understand what you think it should do, and you also need to understand what your customers think it should do. And again, I'm making an assumption here, you're building software to sell to somebody.
Mm.
That's not always the case, but that's been the case for me for 20 years. So,
Even if you're not selling it outside, you're sort of there's users of the software.
There will be users, you're selling it to somebody in some way, right? So you need to understand what they want it to do.
Mm.
And ideally, those two things should be similar, but they might not be the same, because users may want it to do things that are really hard or really maybe impossible, or that just don't make sense. So that's sort of, you need to sort of take that user feedback and form some sort of definition of what functionality you want in the product.
Yeah, and so that is exactly the thing that I'm saying is consistent. That's basically exactly what I'm doing in the hardware world.
Yeah.
But the question about what the capabilities are or what the functionality is, that seems to be, you can talk about that across domain, you know, in some way. Because it's a lot of times the implementation of a certain capability or a certain functionality can be done in many, many different domains.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, they have mechanical clocks and electronic clocks and software clocks and all this sort of stuff. It's all a clock, but implemented in different ways. But it has the same functionality, you know?
Yeah, and I think it's, one of the key things is also to really understand the context of how a user or a customer will use the product.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be, it could be a clock, or it could be, it could be a piece of software, but what are they going to actually use it for? So to take that real simple example, the clock example, are they going to need to use it to tell just sort of roughly what time it is?
Mm-hmm.
Hey, it's about 5 minutes to noon.
Mm-hmm.
Are they going to need to use it to tell a very precise time? So
do they need to,
you know, maybe time something, for example, right?
Yeah.
Down to maybe a millisecond or a sub-millisecond level of accuracy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are two different things, and those products would both be clocks,
yes,
or to some degree timers, timing devices in some sense. But they're completely, you approach them completely differently.
And I agree completely, is that this is exactly one of those things about, defining what you're making, is that I would say that that's a characteristic of the timer in the clock, is how accurate it's going to be. And so that's the thing, that's what we talked about this before, about how specific do you need to get. And getting down to, we're not just making something that makes time, we're making something that makes time with this accuracy, that tells the time with this accuracy and this stability or whatever else.
Well, and beyond that, I mean, it might, again, to use the clock example, might be that if you want to know 5 minutes to noon, an analog device, the hands, might be easier to read, right? You can glance at an analog device pretty quickly and understand where the hands are and what time it is.
Yeah.
But if you're timing, building a timer for, say timing race cars or something, an analog device is not going to work very well. Well, that hand's a little farther along than other one. So you're not going to do that, right? You need like a digital readout. So again, simple examples, but those are the sorts of things I think you need to think about.
Yeah, and so similar stuff shows up. I mean, we're talking about sort of hardware right now.
Yeah.
But similar things show up on the software side, right?
Yeah.
So do you have an example of that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, so you on the software side, you try to understand what the customer is, what sort of pain point the customer is really trying to solve with this product. So let me give you an example that actually just came up recently. So our product, so EverBook does pricing and market analytics for vacation rentals. So if you have a vacation rental, like an Airbnb or a HomeAway property, we can help you understand how much you should charge for it, what other people are charging, all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Well, I was talking to a customer recently, and the customer was telling me, we're talking about our comps tool, which is the tool that lets you understand how much other people are charging, how much other people are making, right? Comparable properties. The customer was telling me, well, what I really need to do is to be able to analyze this data on my own. And I said, well, what do you mean? You've got access to the tool. You can go in and analyze it however you want.
Yeah.
And he says, no, I want to be able to analyze it, directly on my computer. And I'm like, well, it is on your computer. It's on your web browser. I mean, that's on your computer. And as we talked through it, we started to understand that what he really wanted, he's really going to be able to export the data.
Yes.
And bring it into Excel and run a bunch of Excel analysis on this data that we had been providing on our screen. And today, you can't do that. So what I had to get down to is I had to get down to understanding what that core need from the customer was. If I just left it at, oh, I want to be able to do this on my own, I probably would have thought I'd solve the problem because he can log in himself and do it.
Yeah.
But I had to get down to that core need of like, oh no, I want to actually be able to pull this data into another tool and do the analysis that way. And so that's, no major product secrets here, but that may be something we add in the future.
well, then you'd need someone to go and test how many other users want that.
And that's where you get back to that discussion of what do your users want versus what do you want?
Mm-hmm.
And so you have to sort of take that feedback from that customer, from other customers, and other customers are going to have other feedback about different pieces of software, and delve in and pull that back into some sort of universal view of what you think you want and you need to do,
yeah,
and then go forward.
And so that's really great. So now you get this request, basically. So then one of the key things is this about the process is about it's the first thing. It's like you treat it as if you were building it live. Like, you know, what are we really going to build? Not we're not going to hand wave anymore. So we have to get down to, you know, what we actually have to do, and we have to, but at this sort of high level. So
yeah,
when you get to this thing, that there's a translation step from a need to, you know, what you're going to build.
Yeah.
You know, and so I guess the question for you is, when you're doing that translation, do you have a process for translating it into this? You know, I wouldn't say necessarily implementation. Like, it's not like sort of, but it's like. So it's not necessarily low level sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, but it's like architecture, or sort of even maybe even higher than that. Like, what is sort of this first step of translation that you do,
yeah,
to get it from the sort of human domain or the sort of reality and, you know, technology sort of,
yeah,
abstracts that out somehow. So.
So that's the, you know, one of the key roles of the product manager, right? Mm-hmm. Is that they need to listen to a lot of people,
yeah,
and get a bunch of feedback on, it would be really nice if we could do this, it would be really nice if we could do that, and try to ask enough questions about that feedback, as I say, to understand what the customer is really trying to do,
mm,
not necessarily what they say they're trying to do, which
exactly
sometimes are the same, sometimes are different, that depends on the customer. and then you basically have to distill that, and distill it. What I like to do as a product manager is I like to basically, you know, hold myself up somewhere, in a conference room, and at home, in a cafe, whatever, you know, somewhere where I'm not going to be distracted. Tell the team, guys, I'm going on what we call flow mode internally. Basically, it means I'm working, but I'm off the grid. I'm offline. Off-site. If you need something from me that's really urgent, ping me, bug me about it. But if I wait till tomorrow, it should wait till tomorrow. And go into this quote-unquote flow mode. And then basically I start building usually wireframes. Sometimes I'll do text. You know, I'll write things out, try to get my thoughts out on paper, like in a notepad or something like that. But more often than not, it's wireframes. I'm a very big fan, just recently, of the iPad Pro and the Apple Pencil. And there's a product on there I use called Notability, which I really like. And Notability basically allows you to sketch and then share those sketches with your Mac. And it syncs via like iCloud. Shares those sketches with your Mac, with other people. And so you can sketch out wireframes. And essentially what I like to do is take those, you know, sketch those wireframes out, and then take them back to some subset of the customers I talk to and be like, this is what we're thinking about building. Does this look like it would work? Mm-hmm. And usually they're like, well, that looks okay, but it would be really useful if it did this. And you sort of iterate on that process, right, and go through the same thing, update your wireframes.
Mm-hmm. So
now, also called design thinking.
Design thinking, yeah,
yes.
It's all very true.
So for me, you know, doing this sort of thing, so is the wireframe the highest level object in your design?
Yeah, I mean, either a wireframe or, as I say, a set of notes of sort of just the notes I would probably never show to anybody. The wireframes I like to show to people.
So when I've done some stuff that has websites in it or sort of stuff like that, and for me, there's a question about there's the pages themselves, and then there's the connections between the pages. So there's a flow between everything as well as sort of. So I put sort of another piece on top of that. So. I mean, because wireframes. I mean, so I should probably
clarify here.
Yeah,
So I really should probably not use the word wireframes in this case. I really should use the word sketches.
Okay.
Because later in the process, I'll typically take these to more formal wireframes. If it's a product we're developing, I'll actually take it to an actual wireframing tool that will then go through the whole process again. But the reason I like the sketching, I originally like the iPad Pro, is that I can knock out a sketch for a product in, you know, under 5 minutes, typically. It's just like you're drawing on paper, right? It's just like you're sketching something out on paper. It's just it makes it much more shareable. You don't have to go scan it. And that's actually what I used to do, is I used to scan it. Cindy, I think you and I did I believe it was a product summit a few years ago.
Yeah, I was going to say.
And I showed, brought up some scanned versions of my sketches.
Yeah.
So I've upgraded my process since then.
And I also thought you'd be great to come into this process with us because... In that discussion, it was at the Product Summit Oakland. I have to, drop the name. You showed, I remember you talking about your frustration that you had a vision and the designer didn't grasp your vision. They kept coming back with different implementations of what your intention wise.
Well, and I think we've improved that process a little bit even since that meeting a couple of years ago. Because what we do now is that I try to loop the designer, and in my case, I work with a particular individual who's fantastic, who's my UI, UX, and graphic designer. But sometimes these are large, in bigger companies, these are larger teams. But I'll try to loop him in, you know, as early as I can, so he gets to see the sketches.
Yeah.
In fact, sometimes what I'll do now is I'll actually make him make the wireframes, the more formal wireframes from my sketches, because then he starts to take responsibility and ownership of the wireframes and the ultimate design.
Yeah.
You're essentially doing the process, because our intention to bring in the appropriate people early enough.
Yeah.
So it's a collaboration.
So
before we go on, that's actually one point that I thought I want to emphasize here, is this idea that you really, really, really as a product manager, you're sort of an orchestra conductor in some ways.
Yes.
You really want to get other people in the process to buy in and take responsibility. And the nice thing about that is you can often sometimes make them do the work too.
If you're senior enough. So
or if you're good enough
but,
talker.
Yeah, I see the product manager
but,
as a facilitator, getting the right people to the table together.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but you do need to get them to buy in and really understand what's happening, because if you don't, if you sort of try to come in and say, okay, here's a bunch of sketches, a bunch of wireframes, a spec sheet, go build it for me. It doesn't usually work out very well.
And I have some horror stories early in my career where I went into a startup and there were three different distinct engineering teams working on different aspects. No one had a cohesive view. That was my job, to create a cohesive product out of these separate things.
So this is part of what it's about, is having a system to go talk to, you know, part of the thing is big teams. You get everybody in a room, then just this huge mass of like people waiting their turn for 45 minutes before they get their little piece. Whereas this process allows you to go one-on-one. I actually went into a company once and did this where they're having issues, like they weren't getting their product out, basically. So what I did was went through to all the different people, to marketing, to the engineering, to the software people, and went through this process and it was able to get their perspective.
Yeah.
And then I put it all together and sort of found where the conflicts were. And then brought those back up, you know. And so so I think that that's what part of the sort of power of this sort of thing.
Yeah.
That's the sort of next part of this, is that, yes, the wireframes are there. What I call that is one aspect, you know, of a product, but it's not the only thing that's going on. This, you can't just make wireframes and get something, make graphics, and you're done, right? So, you know, there and so there's other things you have to do. There's sort of the back end, I guess, in some way. So how do you integrate, you know, do you have a standard set of things you do on the back end? Does what happens on these wireframes, does that impact what you do on the back end? How does that work?
Well, so you have to have, you know, good people working on each one of those pieces, right?
Yeah.
So you've got to have a guy that's really good at wireframes, and maybe it's a small team. It doesn't have to be one person, but you've got to have somebody that's really good at wireframes, somebody that's really good at design. You've got to have somebody that's really good at back-end engineering. You got to have somebody, again, this is for software. You've got to have somebody that's really good at front-end engineering. You've got to have good people in each of those pieces. What I like to do, and this may not be possible in every company, it's by virtue of me being the boss, I get to do this, but it's something I would encourage, you know, folks to think about, is make some of those teams do the work of the other team. So make the engineering guys do a couple of wireframes. Make the wireframe guys, they probably can't go do any hardcore engineering, but make them try to, make them try to build some small piece of the thing. It may or may not even be something that ends up, you know, in the actual final product. Oftentimes it is, sometimes maybe it's not. But it gives everybody a very healthy respect for what the other guy is doing.
Empathy.
I think that that's a really good point. So, and I think that that's part of, you know, there's this thing about synchronizing everybody together. You know, so everybody's on the same page.
Yeah.
Everybody has buy-in, effectively.
Yeah.
And well, the other part of this process is that you end up with a set of documentation that is supposed to reflect back what is going to be built.
Yeah.
You know, I sort of say it's the first prototype.
Yeah.
And you know, human brains are great because they can simulate anything.
Yeah.
You know? And so the idea is you basically simulate what's going to happen in your brains, all of your brains, and then you put it out on paper, and then you say, does it match with what the vision that you have?
Yeah.
You know, and so you know that, and that the part of the reason about this is that you know, a lot of times, like you said, what is easy and what is hard is that, you know, the client or customer can request anything, but then they have to accept how much it's going to cost to buy, or the manager can request anything, and then it can be how much it's going to cost to make, you know, like in time and budget and stuff. And being able to show that by, you know, being able to compare the different options and seeing, well, this one require, you know, 10 servers and that one require one, or I don't know how, you know, whatever the thing. And you get to see the implication of this capability, what are the implications in terms of how you actually going to build that. So, I mean, I guess the question is, do you see that the sort of, you know, how something is displayed in the screen affects how it's going to actually be implemented on the back end, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think it all, I mean, it, the software always does. I mean, and you want, you know, and you, and there, I mean, there, you know, this isn't the engineering podcast, so we won't, we won't talk too much about that. But I, you know, I mean, there are a lot of choices that can be made from an engineering level that can affect how effectively a product both can be built initially and how effectively it can grow. Because you get, you know, the old line, spaghetti code, where you've got, or what they often refer to as technical debt. And so this is when a product's been in the marketplace for a few years, people have been adding on to it and adding on to it. You get a lot of
feature creep.
Not only feature. I mean, that's part of it, feature creep, but also just code that is really hard to understand, really hard to maintain, really hard to use, really hard to work with, which slows everything down. It makes it hard to iterate. So you do kind of have to look at how something is built up front and what the engineering needs to go into it up front, and that can sort of inform the product process.
Yeah, and so that's the big thing for me, is that my feeling is that, you know, design will impact engineering, which will impact, you know, sort of UI, and so all things, they impact each other. And so what you're trying to do is you're trying to put at sort of, you know, but the other issue about it is that if you're looking at the code itself, that's a huge amount of detail. And so you can't have a designer to look at the code and say, what's wrong with this? Why would this be bad? What you have to do is you have to abstract out the sort of the main pieces so that you get a sort of, I was simple enough view is probably maybe the wrong, but a sort of a high level enough view so that you can see the implications of and see how the different parts interact with each other. And so, you know, for me, the graphics is one aspect. But then, you know, when you're doing software back-end sort of stuff, there's, you know, flow diagrams, and there's sort of, you know, the question about what the product is one of the sort of really big things. And, you know, and when your software, you know, there's the screens on the computer, but sort of what else is it? You know, what else is included in it? There's a sort of, you always have like a servers, you know, do you have... I'm curious. I don't really know.
Yeah, I mean, it depends on the type of software you're making, right? So, for example, say a web application, which is a lot of what we do. You've got servers. You've got, you know, maybe an Amazon, something like that. Amazon Web Services. You know, if you're making an iPhone app, you don't have any servers, and you've got maybe a local development server in your office, maybe. But everybody's just working on their local machines, and then you publish that up to the Apple App Store, and then Apple distributes it out for you. So it really depends on the type of software you're making, but that idea of getting all of the constituents, I guess, all the stakeholders in a room and getting them to sort of all talk through this stuff is valuable. And as I say, I find it particularly valuable to make some of them, not a lot, but some of them, you know, try to basically argue the other guy's viewpoint, right? make the server guy argue the design guy's viewpoint, make the design guy argue the database engineer's viewpoint. They won't ever do a great job arguing it, but it gets the exercise is to get them enough out of their box, their little world box of thinking, to start to consider how their actions impact everybody else. When everybody is considering how their actions impact everybody else, things tend to go a lot more smoothly.
So let's see how we're doing.
We're at the half hour mark.
Okay, good. So let's sort of go on to sort of, we're sort of getting to the sort of, so the next question is, for your things, for your products, sort of what are the things there's three parts to, that I sort of extract out right now. It's sort of what is the product, what does the product do, and what are the sort of interfaces the product has to the other parts of the world. And that those three aspects sort of seem to capture, at least in hardware, and so far as we talked about in software, pretty much capture what you need, a lot of what you need. So I guess the first question is, do you sort of agree with that? Is there something missing?
I think there's one aspect that's missing that's probably, it's probably more prevalent in software than it is elsewhere, but I think it can apply in a lot of cases. And that's, can the technology even do what you think you want it to do? So to give you an example, Everbooked, we process, billions and billions of records of data that we collect and analyze. And so, there was an initial question of, so what, what technology can we use to do that analysis, to actually do the computation, do the calculations? And there's a bunch of options, and we did some prototyping, which I think is a key step, and decided on one. And that's what, that in part informed what we could do from a product standpoint. What that technology can do is informing what kind of graphs we can display, what kind of data we can display, what kind of data processing we can do.
Because
there's things that technology is really good at, and there's things that technology is not as good at. So I think that that's a fourth piece of that, at least for software, piece of that puzzle is like not only what should it do, but what is it possible to do.
Well, for me, the way I sort of work with that is that the product definition or lean spec is about when you're building something. Now there's research and development. There's a research phase when you figure out, if there's something there to make, And I think that for me, part of that phase is when is this sort of these technology questions for feasibility questions.
I would argue though, let's go back to the clock example, right? So you have a product spec, and the product spec says this clock is a timing device for timing race cars. And it needs to go down to nanosecond accuracy. That's the requirement, right? I don't know clocks at all. It's probably completely possible. But hypothetically, if it weren't possible, if there are no timing chips out there that would go down to nanosecond accuracy, then what do you do? Do you invest $5 billion in an R&D lab in a fab, a chip fab, and hire a bunch of chip designers to build a chip that goes down to nanosecond accuracy? Do you say maybe our product should only go to millisecond accuracy?
Well, that's a business case issue. Yeah. That's for the product manager to kind of validate.
Yeah.
Is this possible? And here's what the costs involved are going to be. Yeah. And here's the capabilities of our current team. And here's what it's going to cost to build it out. So you're saying that you would discover that prior to the build, because you're validating, is this worth building or can we build it?
I would say you're discovering that as part of the product development process, part of this iterative process of what does the product need to do. And one of the questions we've got to ask is, we want to do this, can this even be done?
Well, and so I think
or
that
can
that,
it be done at a reasonable cost?
Right?
And that's exactly, I see that as a product management domain. They should come with that kind of data.
And but they can also do it within the process. We can sort of say, well, the project manager or product manager can say, here's what we're trying to do, and then the engineer can say, well, I think that we can see if that's possible, and then go off. But then it means that the definition will have to wait. You can't go forward with the rest of the project until that's been validated or not.
But as a product manager, you also very frequently play the role of a project manager.
Yeah,
that's true.
And so you need to identify that as a possible risk early on because
then you have to go back to the execs or whoever identified this as our next product. This can't be done, or here's why.
Well, it's sort of that there's a thing
or
about
it's not worth doing if there isn't a market for it.
Well, one of the big things this is about is revealing what you don't know.
Yeah.
And so if there's this sort of spec that's come down from marketing or from that sort of thing, and there's a sort of or from a customer, and then the engineers say sort of look at that and say, well, I don't know if we can do that. That's a big thing to know. That's part of what you're trying to reveal early on.
Yeah.
And so I think that is, so again, it's, to sort of take a step back, when you're looking at this sort of set of documentation or this sort of thing, this sort of the definition, reflecting back, at the end of the process, when you've gone through the whole definition, that question has been answered, at some point.
Yeah.
Or
you say it's just a big question mark in red, saying we don't know if
it's
a risk. This is a possibility or not, and then there's a risk associated about moving forward to the next phase.
Yeah.
You know, so it. I mean, the big thing about it is to sort of say, you reveal what you don't know, and then you can decide whether you need to solve that now or wait till you go into the next phase, into the next level of build and start implementing things to actually have that answer.
Yeah.
You know? So I think, so for me, it's not an aspect of a product. It's a thing that, because if you're saying, well, we have this chip that you know, it will give us the accuracy, it becomes one of the things the product is. This timer will have this chip inside it, you know. And so it informs what the product is and what it does, but it's not, that question is not part of the product itself.
Hmm.
Do you see that distinction?
I mean, I disagree, but I think I understand where you're trying to go with it, but I don't agree with it.
This is
important because from a software point of view, so what you're saying is the technology behind the product is key to what the product is.
Well, I agree with that completely.
I would say that you know, in those three things you listed, you have to add this. You have to add this also this layer early on of is it possible, right? And and maybe you solve that by some technical prototyping. Maybe you solve that by some research, or your engineers doing some research. But you got to sort of say, is it possible? Because otherwise, you're building this thing.
It's a high level question immediately in the discovery process.
Yeah.
Well, so this is the distinction I'm trying to pull out. Is that what you're saying? That is a process you go through, right? To feasibility investigation is a process, right?
Yeah.
Now there's an answer to that process, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So what I'm trying to distinguish is saying that that may be part of the product definition process, but the thing that the results. Is it ends up in you make a decision about what you will then build, you know, and so that is part of the product.
But I mean, but that's no different than any other part of the process you go through. If you take customer feedback, right, or you take customer input, and that goes as part of the process, and that ends up as part of the product.
Well, like what I'm saying is that so if you say. The customer input is you want a clock that has nanosecond accuracy. That is translated into a hardware that has temperature conversation, that has moisture conversation, that is that has it's a crystal. You need to use a crystal. That is what the product is, not what and that is the translation of this capability into what you will make.
But if those things didn't exist, if there was no hardware, if there, you know, say you're not Intel, right? You're a small shop, which I think probably most of the listeners are.
Yeah.
And again, I'm not a hardware guy, so I have no idea. But hypothetically, say there was no hardware out there that had moisture compensation and had nanosecond accuracy, all these things, right? There's nothing that you could go, you know, get to put into your product. It doesn't matter how far down the product development process you go. You could have the greatest wireframes. You could have fantastic spec documents. You could have everything all laid out and take it to the engineers, and the engineers just say, well, you know, Malcolm, this is impossible.
Yeah.
And so you don't want to, you know, that's why I'm saying that discovery process has to be done early on, up front.
Yeah. Including the engineers.
Yeah.
It's probably done by the engineers.
So I should say that this process includes the engineers, and they would then say, this thing is, you know, your lead engineer or whoever it's going to be, would raise their hand and say, this is a red flag, or this is something we have to worry about. I have to go and research and make sure that this is possible. But the thing is that the question of whether something is possible is different whether it's in the product, what is in the product or not. I agree, it's sort of, it's a fine distinction.
Yeah.
I think it's very useful because you want to separate out the process you make you go through to figure out what you're making with what you're actually making.
Sure.
You know. So what's not compelling about that?
No, I mean, I guess when we got started on this on this topic, you said sort of there's these three things that goes through as part of the process, and I was just sort of saying there's a fourth thing in my mind.
So
it's all process. I mean,
or approach or orientation to communicating across different domain expertise.
Yeah.
How can we all understand what it is we're trying to do here?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so
and
yeah,
this
no.
isn't really a linear process.
Yeah. No,
it's almost also a way of not having top heavy documentation either.
Yeah, and that's one of the key things I think that's important to think about in you know, the product development process, is that you want to sort of be looking at the whole name of the game is minimizing risks and mitigating risks.
Yeah.
Yep.
And so you want to sort of be looking at a lot of different pieces of it a little bit, and it's sort of like it's, you know, I mean, to your earlier comment about sort of the hierarchy of information, it's kind of like the wedding cake, right? You sort of eat the top layer first, or you go through the top layer first and figure out, okay, so we've gotten, you know, some reasonable degree of understanding or certainty on a number of different aspects of it. And then you say, okay, now let's go through this whole thing again and do the second layer.
Yep.
And you've got a higher degree of understanding. And
you're at a lower...
So I love this analogy. I used to watch Duff on Ace of Cakes. And they were actually engineering these huge customized cakes. And they actually brought in hardware because they had to start with what kind of wood is going to support this huge character that we're going to build out of cake. And they were really extending what is possible. They weren't pastry makers.
Yeah.
They were actually makers who just their medium happened to be baked goods.
And
they would put in explosives in the cake. So they had to think, you know, way ahead. And they did. They had a designer. They would draw it.
Yeah.
And then they had to, the baker, is that possible? And
yeah, so I think this is good. I mean, this is a sort of interesting distinction is that, For me, I think that there is a distinction between this, you know, the product, the results, the deliverable you have for the product definition or the lean spec, is this sort of set of documentation that captures these various aspects.
Yeah.
And that is a different thing than the process you went through to get to that point. You know, so, so I have to think about it, you know, because I agree with you completely that if feasibility is one of the biggest questions you have in any product that's using technology or, you know, anything really, is whether it's possible to make, you know. And so it's an interesting question is that if you came up with, well, we want to hit this, we have this requirement that's part of the capability, but there's nothing that meets that requirement that we can find, you know, what do you do in that situation? How do you capture that in this document and what do you do about it? And that's an interesting question that I want to think about.
Yeah.
But you know, it's sort of interesting thing about the way we think about the product.
Yeah.
I also want to add to it's critical because I work with startup people again, product therapy people who come to me and have these great ideas and they'll have designs and they'll understand the user experience and they'll have the market validation. They have no clue what's involved in the technology or the development of it.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things that I've seen, so Google does an interesting thing where a great many of their product managers are actually engineers.
Oh, they all are.
And
don't get me started with Silicon Valley.
Silicon Valley
what a product
has,
manager needs to be.
Yeah, but there. I mean, I think there's some value to that because somebody who's maybe they're not the most current, the absolute best engineer, but they have a pretty good understanding of it. Maybe the computer science degree in school or whatever it happens to be. They have a good understanding. So when outside influences come in, right? So the stakeholders, you know, internal stakeholders or customers, outside influences come in, they can have a pretty good idea already of what the engineers are going to say when they go and say, let's go build this feature. They may not know the details, but they can have a pretty good idea of like, oh, this is a big project, or this is a big thing, or this is a small thing.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we're talking about, is that this is very clearly one of the things that's required from a product manager is domain knowledge.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, but how much domain knowledge is one of those questions.
Yeah.
And they can't be experts because then they would be doing the engineering.
But they have to know enough to be able to appreciate and talk the engineer's language.
Yeah.
And that's why this was compelling to me to start from an engineer's process and bring it across to product managers. Because that's one of the things I have with Google and Twitter and Facebook. But those product managers managers or engineers, they have the domain expertise, but they're missing all the other pieces of what's required to be a successful product manager, you know, and you can look at all the failed products that Google just throws a product out there, has no clue about the market or the user experience, or and doesn't care and doesn't need to. But for smaller organizations and for people who are choosing, you know, this product management as a career, they need to know all the other pieces of it.
Yeah, I would. I mean, I would disagree with that assessment of Google at least a little bit. In that, in that, Google is throwing a lot of things out there. It's not that they're not thought through. It's that they don't really know what's going to happen, and so they want to test it.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
I think that approach is really valuable.
That's
a lean approach of like.
Let's get it out there and get feedback. Let's fail fast.
Yeah.
But not everyone can afford to do that or has the heart. From my point of view, the most expensive thing is the engineers and the developers. Mm. So we want to look at all the risk involved before nobody else outside of the big companies can afford to launch something and have it fail so often.
Well, I would argue, though, that, I mean, even for small companies, failing fast is a lot cheaper than failing slowly.
Yeah, but if you could, depending on how big their runway
and
is.
I think that this is something we talked about with Anka, about how there is this part of software that allows you to iterate really, really quickly.
Yeah.
But it's also true that there's some parts of the software that are much harder to change.
Yeah.
You know, and so for the UI stuff, for example, and things of that sort, you do a first cut, and then but that iterating is very, very quick. You know? But there's other parts, and this is sort of, you know, the database side, for example, is harder to change on the fly, you know.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's one of the biggest differences between hardware and software the cycle time, once it's up, there can be a lot of churn in parts of it. Which you can't do in any hardware.
Yeah. But I think the real value that the product management brings to the process is that you're a lot less likely to fail, be it fast or slow. You're a lot less likely to fail if you go through some of the product management processes than if you
Thank
don't.
You.
And so that's, you know, and so whether it's hardware or software, I mean, you're right that software is easier to kind of, in some cases, is easier to kind of fix and patch up. But it's much better to sort of get it right from the beginning, because then you are less likely to fail.
Yeah.
And the other thing about this process is that you're creating a group dynamic. So as you were talking about, you're working with people and you've developed a trust and a cohesive way of working together. That's what I see, that this process speeds creating the ability to work together and to learn quickly from experiments or failure.
Yeah. Yeah.
And not have to abandon and start over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's definitely true.
Cool. But this has been lots of fun.
Yeah.
So.
Excellent. Thanks for joining us, David. And
yeah, thank you. A lot of fun.
This is Cindy of Solomon. You can listen to this at blogtalkradio.com/PRODMGMTTALK. You can view the entire series at Startup Product under podcasts. And you can find Malcolm at
engineeraccelerator.com or on Facebook at Engineer Accelerator.
And you can find David at
Ordal.com is the personal site, but Exavault.com and Everbook.com are my two companies.
Great. And we appreciate your feedback, and join us again. Thank you.